And welcome back. Seth Meyers is an award-winning comic who became familiar to millions for his long career with Saturday Night Live. He now hosts NBC's Late Night. Meyers is coming to St. Louis later this week for a performance at the Peabody Opera House on Friday. I had a chance to talk with him earlier this week and asked what kind of a show he's bringing to St. Louis.
Well, I've been doing stand-up for years, and it's something I still enjoy all these years into it. And it's a chance for me to sort of both talk about things that are interesting to me, like politics and what's going on in the world, as well as sort of talking about my own life in a way that my show doesn't really afford me. So it's a delight, and spending an hour plus with an audience full of people is still a thrill that you can't get anywhere else.
I'm glad you mentioned politics, because that's where I wanted to take this interview in the time that we have. People like yourself must just be licking your chops over what's going on in the political world right now.
Well, it certainly is delightful. The more personalities in any sort of presidential election, the easier and better it is for people like me. So it seems to be no shortage of candidates, and hopefully the Democratic field will fill out a little as well, because right now it's an embarrassment of riches on the GOP side.
Who do you feel is most, if I can use this word, vulnerable to comics this season, and who most vulnerable to you?
Oh my goodness, that's a good question. I mean, there's a lot of vulnerability out there. For me, Rick Perry, it'll be interesting to see if he sort of straightened up his act from the last time out. He certainly seems very confident that he won't make the same mistakes. But he was a delight to follow 4 years ago. And especially now it's a little boring, because, you know, I feel like every side is just sort of teeing off on the other side. I think when we actually get into the debates, when, you know, in some cases there'll be as many as 12 people trying to define themselves from one another, that's when we'll start seeing some craziness that I look forward to.
What do you look for? I mean, the gaffe is an obvious target. Rick Perry's oops moment comes to
right.
mind, obviously. But what do you look for aside from the gaffe?
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, the gaffes are sort of, they're obviously fun when they happen, but they're, you know, not sort of indicative of the bigger picture. You know, I think you look for hypocrisy, and you can see it on either side of the political aisle. And I think the more you see these candidates talk, and the more you see them get interviewed, and the more you see them sort of pandering for votes, the more likely you are to catch them saying something completely contradictory to something they've said in the past.
Of course, this is such an extended political season. I guess you have to kind of keep looking all the time and change your routines accordingly.
Yeah, I mean, the only fear is exhaustion from the audience. You know, we certainly don't think it's time to cover, you know, the 2016 election, but it's hard not to, because that's what the press is covering, and that's what I think people are thinking about more and more. So you try to pace yourself in a way that people don't sort of run out of the capacity to be interested by it.
I read in getting ready for this interview that Tina Fey, with whom you worked for so long, credits you with having written some of her best stuff with regard to the Sarah Palin campaign, speaking about easy targets, by the way.
Yeah.
Are you the guy who wrote that most delicious line, "I can see Russia from my house"?
That is actually, that credit goes to Mike Shoemaker, who's a producer here at Late Night with Seth Meyers, worked together with him for years. But it was one of those things, that was a Saturday morning line. We'd written that script. We felt really good about it. I was just looking for one or two more jokes. And it was one of those things that when he said it, everyone in the room really got really quiet, because they knew that an excellent joke that would probably last for a very long time had just been uttered.
Give me some sense of the process for things like that. I mean, obviously, we Sarah Palin was an easy target, but go through what you went through just coming up with the weekly stuff about Sarah Palin and others.
Well, you know, the Sarah Palin thing was very unique to my time at SNL, because as soon as John McCain picked her, I think everyone was waiting for Tina Fey to play her. You know, that was like sort of the first thing people said about Sarah Palin, was they reminded her of Tina Fey. Tina at the time, you know, wasn't on SNL anymore. We had to sort of convince her to come back and do what ended up being 6 or 7 sketches. You know, and it wasn't like she wasn't busy. She was not only a mother, but she was, you know, the writer, executive producer, and star of 30 Rock. And I'm gracious to this day that she sort of found the time to come back and do those sketches. And once we did the first one, the hardest part was just trying to maintain the quality of the first one, which we all kind of thought was a pretty special sketch, and just trying to come up with new and unique ways to write Sarah Palin sketches, and sometimes, you know, ultimately it was less writing and more transcription, which is when you know you've got, one of the easier targets you're ever going to have.
It's a different kind of pressure, I have to assume, getting material ready for Saturday Night Live, a weekly program, as opposed to what you're doing now. This is a five-day-a-week deal.
Yeah, I mean, it is very different. You know, at SNL, obviously, you have the – because you only get the one shot at it, there's the pressure that way of, like, we really have to nail it on Saturday, whereas here, just because of the volume of stuff you do, you can be a little bit less precious about it. But on the same end, you know, you have to spend your whole day leading up to the taping, generating material that you're happy with so that that hour of the show goes well. So they're very different beasts, but each have their own stresses to them.
How much of the writing for late night do you do yourself, and how many writers do you have?
We have 10 to 12 writers. I try to do a fair amount of the writing, but I have a little bit less time these days just because, you know, in the other side of things, you have to prepare yourself for interviews. You know, you have to familiarize yourself with materials for your guests. And but it's always, you know, I'm always happier if there's something I've written in the show. As a writer, I still find that very rewarding.
Is this a format that you're really comfortable with?
I'm getting more comfortable as we go. You know, the other nice thing is, unlike SNL, where, again, you get the only once a week to perform here, getting to do it every night, your learning curve is a little bit faster, and you get better at a quicker pace. And so that part of it I really enjoy.
Well, you know, one of the things that occurs to me in thinking about what's happening at night, and I'll take the early evening part of this as well, is that that landscape is changing with Jon Stewart leaving, Colbert changing, going to the Letterman slot. You're relatively new. What do you make of what's going on in the early evening and late at night?
It's an exciting time, I think, for not only the people who get to do these shows, but for audience members as well. I think if you like comedy, you'd be hard-pressed not to find something you like, not find something that you feel like is tailored to your sensibilities. You know, I think that the group of people that are doing comedy on television right now have a lot of similarities, but a lot of differences as well. And not only is it a fun new time for people who do sort of conventional talk shows, but I think there's so many great sketch shows now outside of SNL, which is really exciting too. So it's a good time, I think, to be making comedy, a good time to be watching it.
A lot of competition out there for you.
Yeah, there certainly is a lot of competition, but you know, it's I think that, you know, the very fact that right now that I do still feel like late night is a destination for people. You know, I'm just very happy to be one of the many choices they have.
You're working with a lot of people who once worked with David Letterman in that slot. And, of course, his departure left a big hole that Colbert will fill. And you paid special tribute to Letterman just a short time ago. Talk about him and his influence on late-night comedy.
Well, you know, for me, you know, growing up, I was at the age where I didn't have much of a relationship with The Tonight Show and Johnny Carson. I was certainly aware of him and had seen him here and there. But Letterman was the first time I felt like I was seeing someone do the kind of show that I wanted to watch. And just as far as risk-taking and the amount he sort of broke the template is something, you know, not only did I admire, but that we aspire to do.
How might he have influenced you specifically?
Well, you know, I think what I always found is that Letterman never seemed to be doing anything he didn't enjoy doing. And, you know, that's something I always have tried to – that standard is something we've tried very hard to do with Late Night.
The importance of improvisation, that's how you got started. That's how many of the people that you worked with on SNL got started. I'd like to ask you the importance of that kind of training for the kind of thing that you do now, not only on late night, but also in places like the Peabody here in St. Louis when you're here.
Well, you know, being an improviser means being a good listener. And for me, it probably comes in handy most during the interviews, just being able to listen to people, you know, come up with jokes on the fly that sort of aren't planned in advance. You know, a lot of comedy comes from sort of your written comedy comes from your ability to sort of talk it out, which is, you know, using your improvisational skills there. You know, as far as like what I bring to the Peabody, like that's That's pretty well written at this point. Like, I think with stand-up, you're constantly trying to sort of carve it and make it better. So for me, it's less spontaneous, mostly because I'm very happy with the shape I have it in now. With that said, you know, improvising is still something I love doing. And on the nights, you know, even during a monologue, sometimes something will happen that'll lead to sort of a moment of improvisation, which oftentimes are sort of my favorite moment of the night.
When you come to the Peabody or any other cities, is there ever any temptation? I mean, I know you've got your script and your whole thing down. Any temptation to tailor what you do to a particular city or part of the country?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, you are, if there's something that you're naturally aware of in that city or that place, you are, it's fun to talk about it. I think it's hard to sort of educate yourself on sort of, you know, things that are local that you don't really know much about. I think people can always tell when you're sort of trying too hard to tailor. But if there's stuff that you're aware of, I think that's always fun to do.
I think of that commercial in which someone says, "Good evening, Detroit," and he's
right.
someplace
exactly.
else. That can get you into trouble.
That could get you into trouble right away.
One other thing I wanted to talk to you about was the Correspondents' Dinner. I think it was 2011, in which you were the MC of that particular event. I can't imagine performing in a venue like that. What in the world is that like?
Yeah, it's weird sort of looking back at it, even sort of remembering that I did it. You know, it's strange enough to perform for that room, which is sort of, you know, 2000 DC elite and a very, very bad room for comedy, sort of a hotel ballroom. As a comedian, if you heard that was your venue, you would be very upset. And making matters worse, you know, you're standing next to and making jokes about the president. So the audience isn't watching you as much as they're watching the president watch you. And you're very aware of that as well. And I would say the 2 hours are very out of body. And when it's over, you're very happy if you feel like you survived it all.
What about preparing for it? I mean, you've got to be somewhat cautious. You want to be funny, but you don't want to be rude or crude, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, you know, really it was just we spent so much time preparing. We wrote so many jokes. And, you know, you were aware of, yes, again, you don't want to be rude or crude, but at the same time, you don't want to make it seem like you're not taking any chances. Like, that's kind of part of the fun of doing a show like that is, you know, you want to take a few swings that hopefully people will remember you for.
And response from the president in 2011, was there any directly to you?
Really just sort of a handshake and good job afterwards. Of course, you know, the other thing is, the president is excellent at it. I think in the history of Correspondents' Dinners, he's by far been the funniest president. So mostly you're just trying to hold the serve that he's provided with his act.
Obviously, it would be intimidating to have the president there and other officials and the first lady and what have you. But the audience is interesting, too, because you've got some of the most important media people in the country. This is more along the lines of your field, but they can be critics as well.
Very much so. I mean, that we did approach it as we reminded ourselves that it wasn't just making fun of politicians, but also making fun of the people who cover politicians. And I think that got us off to a good start, because I feel like once the media realized that we were going to also make jokes about them, because I feel like most people in the media like attention, whether it's positive or negative. You know, we opened with a lot of jokes about the press, and I think that got us off to a good start with the audience. And again, it is D.C. is a place where people are definitely looking around to see if the other people are laughing. And so you don't want to lose the room because it's very hard to get them back.
I remember reading a book recently in which they talked about some of the people in the room are what are called destinations. Folks want to be seen with them, so they make it a point to go to them. They are a destination, per se, so that they can be seen with them. A lot of that going on?
A lot of that going on. I mean, the craziest thing is you're sitting on a dais, and I was sitting next to the First Lady, and just the amount of people who just walk up with their cell phones and just sort of point it at the First Lady and take a picture. You know, by the way, a picture that is going to be worse than one that will be in the paper the next day. But people just like to take photos of other people and prove they were in a room with them. And that night is the one where that was, I've never seen it more strongly than that.
There is some criticism of those dinners because the people covering the president and the newsmakers, if you will, the power people, are rubbing shoulders with him, and it's felt that maybe they shouldn't be doing that. Maybe they shouldn't be socializing. What do you think?
Well, look, I think that the socializing doesn't lead to the bad result from the press. It's more that, like, bad reporting will lead to things like the White House Correspondents' Dinner more than the other way around. But I would think that there's a lot of criticism of the White House Correspondents' Dinner that is perfectly fair. On the other hand, you know, if you look at the night as pure entertainment, it gets the job done too.
Would you do it again?
I don't know if I would. I feel like I did a good enough job, and I feel like I should probably walk away from the table with my money.
What does it do for your career to have done that?
I think it helps people see me as something other than a person on SNL. It is obviously it's the definition of sort of hosting when you do something like that. And I think standing up in that room and doing that probably is some indirect way led to this next chapter for me. So I'm very happy I did it.
That's Seth Meyers. He'll be appearing at the Peabody Opera House this Friday evening. We have details on our website at stlpublicradio.org. That's it for us for today. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the local and national status of marriage equality. We'll also hear Veronique LeCapra's discussion with Steve Bircher, curator of mammals at the St. Louis Zoo, about the new exhibit that will feature a polar bear. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.